Today is Monday, August 31st, and it is time to read from the Sioux City Journal. My name is Barb, and I will be reading to you today stories of local interest, the weather, sports, and all sorts of great information for the next 50 minutes. So let's get started. What's it like, and what's the weather going to be like? Oh my, we have a nice cool streak for a few days going here. Today, very pleasant after the morning showers with clouds and sun. High of 77, tonight low of 48, so it'll be a little cooler. Tuesday, mostly cloudy, high of 77, low of 54. Starts getting warmer on Wednesday with plenty of sunshine, high of 89, low of 62. Thursday, sunny, breezy, and not quite as warm, high of 78, low of 49. And Friday, pleasant with plenty of sunshine, high of 84, low of 58. So it sounds like a pretty nice week coming up. Let's check in on today's mini editorial. Excuse me. The mini today is brought to us by Matthew O'Kane of Sioux City. And Matthew says, in response to Sunday's mini writer, if you're finding bias in reporting, there are two reasons. Number one, the news sources you're relying on are not reputable and serve for entertainment. And number two, your own bias is showing. I suggest you consult reputable news sources. If their message does not align with your views, I'm afraid you've succumbed to the entertainment. This is the opinion of Matthew O'Kane of Sioux City. And let's go to today's top story. Sport bettors finish rookie year. Legal wagering on games began strong, but pandemic took a toll. In Des Moines, while not an MVP season, sports betting in Iowa is getting good marks for a hit-and-miss rookie year. Iowans who took advantage of a new law that allowed them to begin legally betting on professional and collegiate sports events a year ago, August 15th of 2019, wagered more than $400 million in the first year. A new gambling opportunity that provided a roughly $30 million shot in the arm to 19 state-licensed casinos that were rocked by a coronavirus pandemic that closed them for 11 weeks and brought athletic competition at all levels to a halt. Casino operators were delighted when legalized sports betting broke strong from the gates, with revenue and attendance climbing in the first 6 months of the fiscal year. But then it crumpled down the stretch when Governor Kim Reynolds ordered gambling parlors and many other businesses closed last March to slow the spread of the COVID-19. The pandemic also forced the cancellation of major sports when college basketball and other betting attractions were in full swing, and Iowa's casinos saw their net proceeds sliced by about 20% to post their lowest revenue totals since fiscal 2006. And the lowest attendance numbers since 1996. It's difficult to gauge what expectations could or should have been when we had an unprecedented year like we did, said Wes Erke, the spokesperson for the Iowa Gaming Association, an umbrella group for the state-licensed casinos. Brian Ohoroloco, administrator for the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission, said it is difficult to gauge Iowa's first year of legalized sports wagering, given the erratic nature of the coronavirus-riddled business model. But overall, he believes Iowa casino operators were pleased with how the added amenity performed. Going into this, nobody was quite sure of this. We had seen what was happening in other states like New Jersey and Nevada, and this was back last year when the legislature was contemplating whether or not to offer sports wagering. I think most of the operators were happy, said Orillico. I don't think anyone who was close to the industry expected significant numbers. I think the goal all along was to have another profit center that was popular to customers and maybe would attract some new customers. Legislative fiscal experts had projected sports wagering would generate up to $1.8 million in state tax revenue and possibly up to nearly $560 million in wagering activity. The state's take came in pretty close to that mark. While betting activity was near $60 million, monthly pace suddenly went from $327 million to zero in March. That was unfortunate that just when it was hitting its stride and coming off the football season and ready for March Madness and the conference tournaments and everything was shut down. There weren't any sports to wager on, professional or collegiate in the U.S. or the U.K. because of the coronavirus. It wasn't only the coronavirus that held back Iowa's opening year, according to Max Bischel, an executive with Gambling.com Group. He said the requirement in Iowa law that sports bettors for the first 18 months must physically travel to a state-licensed casino to establish an account in person contributed to a subpar first year and muffled participation, especially for Iowans who live in rural areas that are not close to an urban gambling enterprise. After that in-person visit, gamblers can place bets online with an app for the casino. The obstacle of in-person registration creating some friction for customers will remain until January 1st, when the requirement ends and Iowans age 21 years or older who prove residency can establish an account online. Bischel believes that may double Iowa's wagering numbers. I think the prospects for 2021 is that things should open up fairly significantly. You'll have more operators enter the market in Iowa, and for customers, it will be easier for them to wager on sports just because they won't have to go to the casino to register. In some cases, that's quite a task. I think you'll see positive momentum going into Iowa for 2021. Ohorlico said online sports wagering topped retail bets placed in person at casinos by about $100 million. Especially when virus concerns made remote wagering the preferred option. The state gaming administrator said at least 8 new sportsbook companies have applied to be licensed to operate in Iowa as the January 1 registration change approaches. Casinos will be able to have up to 2 individually branded websites per location, with the commission authorized to go to 3 if they so choose. That will allow gamblers to shop around and download different apps and compare sports book odds. As it currently stands, he said, he has heard of gamblers driving from Des Moines to the casino in Jefferson or other locations to be able to access internet sites that offer fantasy sports or options not available to them locally. State Senator Roby Smith, a Republican from Davenport, who played a key role in getting the sports wagering legislation passed and signed into law by Reynolds, said the first year went as well as could be accepted, given the COVID-19 disruptions, and was pleased no major compliance issues or other concerns emerged with the state's latest gambling expansion. I think probably the biggest surprise was a little more online usage than most thought would happen. Despite criticism, Smith said he believed it was the right thing to do to require the in-person registration for the first 18 months as a security precaution for a new gambling option. I think it's an unfortunate time as far as we don't have an accurate reading on what the demand will be because you don't have the normal level of sports out there. But you also don't have to have people that have to go inside a casino if they don't want to. They have the online option to place their wagers, and I think that's there's safety measures in that. I think there is good and bad for the year 2020 in dealing with online sports wagering. Fiscal 2021 is not starting out great for sports wagering in Iowa, with the Big Ten canceling fall football and the uncertainty swirling around professional teams. I think the word unprecedented gets overused significantly, but COVID is severely an unprecedented event, a true black swan event, especially in this country. Specific to sports, obviously it shut everything down. We missed March Madness, we missed major golf tournaments, the playoffs for the Major League Baseball, for the NHL, for the NBA. They're going to happen, but in a different capacity with limited games. While it wasn't a complete year to compare to with all of the COVID events, Irecki said of Iowa's first year of legalized sports betting. Still, it's getting itself established and will continue to improve once we get beyond this pandemic and we can get sports back to what may be a new phase of normal. Let's look at other front page news. There's a lovely picture of three brothers from left, Colin, Quentin, and Liam Greenwell, who have been taking flight lessons for more than 2 years. Colin and Liam, who are 17-year-old twins, and 18-year-old Quentin, have all recently completed their solo flights and are on target to earn their pilot's license within the next year or so. And the title is Brothers to Be Pilots. The Greenwell teens find passion for air flight. Twin brothers Colin and Liam Greenwell began taking flying lessons at 17, the same age many of their peers were learning to drive. Actually, we already have our driver's license, Liam quipped. Now we're studying for our pilot's license, added Colin, who, like Liam, is a North High School senior. Both twins recently completed solo flight tests needed to secure their FAA credentials. So did their brother Quentin, 18, a soon-to-be University of Oregon student. That puts all three brothers on track to become licensed pilots at a younger age than their dad, Dan Greenwell. I earned my pilot's license when I was 20, said Dan Greenwell, a businessman and Sioux City Community School board member. Yeah, we want to beat Dad's record, Colin said with a smile. That'd be cool, said a laughing Liam. Well, it was actually their dad who encouraged the boys to begin flight lessons more than 2 years ago. I wanted my sons to be lifelong learners, said Greenwell. They may never become professional pilots, but this is a skill set that they'll see as an accomplishment for the rest of their lives. To be honest, it was a skill that Quentin had initially no intention of acquiring. Taking flying lessons was literally the last thing I wanted to do, he admitted. But then, when a bit of sibling peer pressure came in handy. You see, Quentin was born in January of 2002, and Liam and Colin were born 11 months later. Even though I'm the older brother, according to the calendar, I've never felt like an older brother. It turns out all three of us began flying lessons at the same time. Eventually, Quentin started to enjoy his time in the wild blue yonder as much as his younger brothers. For sure, it puts everything into perspective. Taking a math exam seems less intimidating once you pass a solo flight test. Actually, the lessons learned at flight school can also come in handy in a more conventional classroom setting, said Colin. When you're a pilot on a plane, you need to keep your cool, stay focused, and be able to multitask with confidence. That will help you out in school. Taking flying lessons has made Quentin less patient when it comes to careless drivers. The craziest thing about flying lessons is the drive back home. When flying a plane, you're keeping tabs on everything. Driving a car, you're essentially steering, accelerating, braking, and that's it. Some people can't even handle it on those skills. Plus, you never read about cars falling from the skies, Liam said. There's no excuse for bad driving. Another thing that the brothers agree upon, they all want to see the new Top Gun Maverick, which comes out next summer. The original Top Gun made aviation look pretty cool, said Colin. But plenty of the stuff is wrong. That's Hollywood, I guess. They have to glamorize things. For instance, the F-14 Tomcat that Tom Cruise flew in Top Gun is a lot sleeker than the Greenwell family's 1972 Beechcraft Skipper single-engine training plane. But Colin said it gets the job done. The big drawback when flying in the summertime? No AC, he said. It's warm in the summer and cool in the winter. While the skipper has a small vent that blows a bit of air, it still gets stuffy, said Liam. Luckily, it's cooler up in the clouds. Despite these drawbacks, the brothers say they'll likely be getting their licenses in the next year or so. Quentin said his friends already want to bum rides off of him. I tell them if they're not willing to chip in for fuel money, no way, he said, chuckling. You can't blame their friends for being impressed by the high-flying hobby of the brothers. Our parents said there weren't very many kids who were given this opportunity to take flying lessons, Liam said. We'd be kicking ourselves if we didn't take advantage of it. While the brothers are talking careers in business, physical therapy, or psychiatry when they get older, each said an aviation career will also now be on their radar. No matter what you do, it's good to have a fallback plan, said Quentin. Before this, I never thought about flying a plane for a living. Now, at least it's a possibility. And there's a couple great pictures, one of Quentin Greenwell sitting in the pilot seat of his father's 1972 Beechcraft Skipper single-engine plane at the Sioux City Airport on Wednesday. And lastly, a picture of Liam Greenwell climbing into the cockpit of his father's plane Wednesday at the airport. Liam and his two brothers are learning to fly this 1972 Beechcraft Skipper single-engine airplane. Okay, we'll continue on. On the news membership at the SiouxCityJournal.com, a couple things you can go online to see. If you haven't seen Irresistible, change that, said Bruce Miller. It's one of many reasons why to get in this week's DVD review. Irresistible is a show starring Steve Carell, a movie. And then a peek inside. Enjoy a virtual tour of celebrity homes from the comfort of your own home with the online exclusive photo gallery. This week, houses owned by John Legend, Gene Simmons, and more in the SiouxCityJournal.com photo gallery in the housing section. And for something different, if you're feeling stuck in a breakfast rut, check out our online list of innovative yet easy options to try for the most important meal of the day, and that is breakfast. We're going to move on now to Sioux County. COVID positive rate now is the third in Iowa. In Orange City, Sioux County's percentage of positive COVID-19 tests has continued its precocious climb. And even as the percentage has increased in many other counties, Sioux County now has the third highest percentage in the state. During the past 2 weeks, 21.8% of all COVID-19 tests in Sioux County have come back positive. This puts the county just behind Plymouth County's 23% and Johnson County's 22.5%, according to data from the Iowa Department of Public Health. 1 week ago, Sioux County's positive percentage was only 14%. That figure had climbed considerably from the week before. Other Northwest Iowa counties have recorded sizable jumps in their positive percentages, including O'Brien, now 14%, and Crawford, 15.8%. The percentage of COVID tests coming back positive is generally taken as a sign that more infections are going unreported and that the virus in general is spreading more aggressively. In absolute terms, a total of 197 positive tests have been recorded in Sioux County in the past 2 weeks, and about 296 have active infections, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health data. In Plymouth County, roughly 219 positives were tallied in that time frame, and 293 presently have active infections. Woodbury County, to the south of Sioux and Plymouth, has a 2-week positive percentage of 11%. Less than 2 weeks ago, that figure was 7.4%. During the last 2 weeks, just shy of 300 positive tests were tallied in Woodbury County, and 503 in the county were thought to have active infections. 4 long-term facilities in Northwest Iowa are currently dealing with outbreaks, 2 of them in Plymouth County. Statewide, a total of 37 long-term facilities are currently experiencing known outbreaks. Outbreaks at these facilities have been devastating in Iowa. As residents, they represent a disproportionate share of the state's COVID-19 deaths. As of Sunday, 598 of the state's 1,112 deaths were associated with these facilities. At the Good Samaritan Society in Lamar's, 32 people have tested positive. At Kingsley Specialty Care in Kingsley, 7 have tested positive. And the Prairie View Home in Sanborn, 22 have tested positive. At the Good Samaritan Society in George, Iowa, 17 have tested positive. Previous outbreaks at long-term care facilities in the area have apparently resolved. Meanwhile, at the University of South Dakota in Vermilion, the number of students infected with the virus climbed again Sunday. Currently, 221 students have tested positive, and 563 students and staff are in quarantine. Moving to other news, injury reported in Lamar's duplex fire Saturday night. In Lamar's, one person suffered injuries in a Saturday night fire at a duplex in Lamar's. According to a press release from the Lamar's Fire Rescue at around 9:43 p.m. Saturday, Lamar's firefighters and Lamar's ambulance and the Lamar's Police Department were called to a duplex in the 600 block of Greenwood Avenue for a structure fire in a person who had suffered burns. Upon arrival, firefighters found a one-story duplex with heavy smoke coming from the north side. A male individual who had been burned in the fire was on the front lawn and was being transported by the Lamar's ambulance to Floyd Valley Healthcare. His condition is not known. Firefighters knocked the fire down quickly, and the second unit in the duplex was found to be unoccupied as the resident was out of town. The fire was determined to be accidental in nature, most likely caused by a cooking accident with a flash fire that ignited nearby combustibles and burned the male individual. Firefighters from Lamar's and Orange City were on the scene for more than an hour. The Plymouth County Sheriff's Office and Mid-American Energy workers were also on the scene. Damage to the duplex is estimated at more than $20,000. The duplex unit where the fire occurred is not livable at present due to the damage. In other news, in Nebraska, Nebraska Medical Marijuana Initiative challenged in court. In Lincoln, Nebraska, the Nebraska Supreme Court will decide whether to allow voters to decide whether to legalize medical marijuana in November. Lancaster County Sheriff Terry Wagner filed a challenge on Friday to Secretary of State Bob Evnen's ruling that the medical marijuana ballot initiative qualified to be on the ballot. Evnen said a day earlier that the Nebraskans for Medical Marijuana Group had collected well over 122,000 signatures it needed to put the issue on the ballot. Opponents of the measure argue that it violates state rules requiring ballot measures to focus on a single question. Lincoln attorney Mark Falson, who is a former Nebraska Republican Party chairman, is representing Wagner. He said the measure poses two separate questions: whether residents should have the right to use marijuana for medical purposes, and whether private companies should be allowed to grow it and sell it. Organizers of the ballot measure have said they're highly confident that the measure will survive the legal challenge, and they argue that the medical marijuana has strong support in Nebraska. Lawyers for the pro-medical marijuana group said in a letter that the legal challenge is a, quote, last-minute attempt to derail the precious right of the people to vote on voter-supported initiatives. In other Nebraska news, Nebraska prison quarantined after 29 inmates have virus. In Lincoln, Nebraska, the Nebraska State Penitentiary in Lincoln has been placed under quarantine after 29 inmates tested positive for the coronavirus. The positive cases were identified by tests that were done Friday. Nebraska Department of Correctional Services Director Scott Frakes said the positive cases included inmates in four different housing units, so the entire prison was placed under quarantine. "We are acting out of an abundance of caution," Frakes said in a news release. "This move will allow us to continue testing the remainder of the population." Officials said roughly 600 inmates were initially offered tests under the voluntary program, and 332 agreed to be tested. The remaining inmates will be offered tests starting on Sunday. Frakes said most of the inmates who tested positive had not had symptoms. Warden Michelle Wilheim said the entire facility will be under quarantine for at least 2 weeks. Frakes said prisoner visits will remain on hold across the agency while the penitentiary is in quarantine. There have been 64 correction department employees who have tested positive since the virus outbreak began. Of those, 54 have recovered from the illness. In Iowa, the Iowa virus numbers vary widely because of a website problem. The numbers on Iowa's online coronavirus tracker varied widely this weekend because of a maintenance problem with the site. The Iowa Department of Public Health reported Saturday morning that 1,108 Iowans have died from COVID-19. Later in the day, the number of deaths fell to 894, before rebounding Saturday evening to 1109. Several other key statistics fluctuated on the state website Saturday. For instance, the number of cases of coronavirus dropped from 63,100 to 51,100 before being restored after 9 p.m. Saturday. Department of Public Health spokesperson Amy McCoy told the Des Moines Register by email late Saturday that the problem appeared to be fixed. A maintenance upgrade to the state's website caused the numbers to fluctuate temporarily. The state health department has been criticized recently for other problems with its statistics. Governor Kim Reynolds said on August 20th that the state had been incorrectly attributing many recent coronavirus test results to several months ago. The error affected the positivity rates that the state reported, which is what school districts are relying on as they decide whether to send children back to school. Around 7 p.m. on Sunday, the state's online virus tracker said there had been 62,785 coronavirus cases and 1,112 deaths linked to the virus in Iowa since the pandemic began. The 7-day rolling average of daily new cases in Iowa has risen over the past 2 weeks from 501 cases per day to 859 new cases per day on August 29th, just 2 weeks later. So difficult to keep track of the statistics. One more article on the virus. South Dakota exceeds 13,000 confirmed coronavirus cases. South Dakota health officials say the state has exceeded 13,000 total confirmed cases of the virus. The South Dakota Department of Health on Sunday reported 380 newly confirmed cases of the virus, raising the total to 13,322. The Argus Leader reports that more than 2,000 cases have been reported in the last 7 days. That accounts for 15% of South Dakota's total cases during the pandemic. No new deaths were reported, keeping the total at 167. And of the new cases reported Sunday, over half were attributed to people from the ages of 10 to 29. Officials report 154 of them were people aged 20 to 29, and 60 were those between 10 and 19. Pennington County in western South Dakota reported the most new cases on Sunday with 69. Minnehaha County, the state's most populous county, reported 57 new cases. We'll continue to move on. I don't believe that we have any obituaries today. Speaking of obituaries, I am going to read this one article about Chadwick Boseman. Boseman's death leaves sad mark on rough 2020. And this is in Los Angeles. Kobe Bryant, Republican John Lewis, and now Chadwick Boseman. So far, 2020 has been marred with bad news and tragedy with the deaths of several popular black icons, including Bryant, Lewis, and most recently Boseman, who died Friday. All three were viewed as leaders in their respective fields of sports, politics, and film. Places where people, particularly in the black community, have often looked for inspiration during a year of racial tension and protests against the police brutality of unarmed black people. But for many, the loss of another major figure such as Boseman is taking a toll. The actor who starred in the blockbuster superhero Marvel film Black Panther shockingly died at the age of 43 in his home in L.A., after he privately battled colon cancer for 4 years. "There are pillars in our community," said Reverend Al Sharpton. "In times of instability, you depend on pillars. It's bad enough when there's a storm outside and you hear the lightning and thunder. It gets worse when the pillars that you're building and standing on are shaking. It's like they're chipping away at our foundation. The very building is shaking down because the things that undergird and protect us from the storms are being removed." Sharpton called Boseman an important pillar who humanized several black historical trailblazers in his roles, including color line breaking baseball star Jackie Robinson, legendary singer James Brown, and the first African-American U.S. Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. Bozeman's family said he endured countless surgeries and chemotherapy while portraying King T'Challa of Wakanda in the Oscar-nominated Black Panther movie, a film that proved a person of color could lead in a successful superhero film. For him to pass at this time when we are disproportionately affected by COVID and have all these attacks by law enforcement, and with him being the symbol bringing us to Wakanda, it's just a blow, said Sharpton. To hear that our superhero who projected a positive light was gone now, it was quite a blow. Bozeman was elevated to a stage that many Black actors don't get the chance to occupy, said L.A. Lakers star LeBron James, and his ability to be transcendent on that stage brought a comic book character to life for many in the Black community. Even though we knew it was like a fictional story, it actually felt real. It actually felt like we finally had our Black superhero and nobody could touch us. So to lose that, it's sad in our community, James said. He was lamenting on the loss of the Black Panther and the Black Mamba in the same year. In January, Kobe Bryant died in a helicopter crash involving 8 others, including his 13-year-old daughter, Gianna. Lewis died in July after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer last year. Other notable deaths this year include actress Naya Rivera, civil rights leader C.T. Vivian, and music executive Andre Harrell. The year 2020 has been up and down for everyone, Milwaukee Bucks player Jhenius Ekwemutombo said, adding that Bozeman left so much behind. It's a lot to unpack, said the Sioux City, the Oklahoma City Thunder guard Chris Paul. Chadwick was a special guy. I think everyone took it hard, especially the Black community. That was one of our Black superheroes. I think Black Panther was something so powerful for myself along with my kids to see a superhero that looks like them. And the way that he played it was such class and elegance. It was tough. Activist Martin Luther King III called Bozeman's death another great loss, but he encouraged people not to lose hope, even in the year of tumult. We could easily say, oh my, this is the most terrible year that existed. But I choose not to say that, said the son of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Our ancestors had to go through so, so much, and yet we're still here. We are nowhere that we need to be, but we are always making progress and moving ahead. Gil Robertson, the co-founder and president of the African American Film Critics Association, said Black people are at a critical crossroads of their survival in America. We're getting it from all sides of the fort, Robertson said. We're losing these strong men, these men who operated with a level of integrity, a level of authenticity. I find all of this alarming, and I hope our community can really come together, not just for one cause, just to make a consistent effort to rehabilitate our community. Okay. In looking further, there aren't a lot of stories of local interest, so I'm going to go back to yesterday's Sioux City Journal, and in the health section, there's quite a nice article about what to know about flu shots. This article is by Stacy Burling, and it's called COVID-19 Complicates Vaccine Access and Testing, What to Know About Flu Shots. Bad as it has been these past few months to live with the danger of the coronavirus, things are about to get worse. Fall is approaching, and with it comes that other respiratory virus that puts thousands of Americans in the hospital every year. Influenza. Prepare for an onslaught of public service messages begging you to get a shot, not only to protect yourselves and your vulnerable loved ones, but an entire health system already strained by the COVID-19 pandemic. Hospitals often fill up in December and January when flu season really takes off, said Susan Bailey, an allergy and immunology specialist in Fort Worth, who is president of the American Medical Association. If hospitals are already full of coronavirus patients, where are the influenza patients going to go? She asked. The AMA encourages flu vaccines every year, but will have a larger campaign with the U.S. Centers of Disease Control and Prevention and the Ad Council this year. To further complicate matters, the symptoms of the flu and COVID-19 can be so similar that doctors won't be able to test them apart without testing. A new test that can detect influenza A, influenza B, and COVID-19 has received emergency authorization from the FDA, but is not yet available. That means patients could need two tests to get a diagnosis. Doctors know that patients can get the coronavirus and the flu at the same time. They do not know yet whether that results in worse illness than either would cause alone, but it stands to reason that it might. Flu and the coronavirus tend to be the most dangerous for the same groups, the elderly and those with chronic health problems. But worries about coronavirus could make vaccination more challenging, said William Schaffner, Medical Director for the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases and Professor of Preventative Medicine and Infectious Diseases at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. Telemedicine can't deliver vaccines, he said, and the rates for other types of vaccination have dropped. The foundation is also stepping up vaccination promotion efforts, especially for people with chronic illness. On the other hand, demand could be unusually high for what may feel like a rare and much-needed act of control. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, drug manufacturers say they will produce 194 million to 198 million doses of vaccine this season, up from 175 million last year. While some doctor offices have not yet received flu vaccines, some pharmacies are already putting out the signs saying it's time to get one. With all that in mind, here are answers to some questions you may have. Number one, when should I get my shot? Ideally, doctors said it's best to wait until September or well into November. Into October. Schaffner suggests mid-September to mid-November. The effectiveness on the shot wanes over time. In most people, it stays strong for 6 months or so, but people over 65 tend to lose immunity more quickly. Waiting a little longer to get the shot improves the odds that you will be protected until the end of the season, which is usually around March or April. However, it takes 2 weeks to get the shot's full benefit, so you might want to get it before cases become more common in the fall. That's often in November. If you haven't already gotten sick, you can get shots into the spring. But if it's convenient to get it sooner, especially if you're young and healthy, go ahead and take it. The best time to get the flu vaccine is any time, said Rachel Levine, Pennsylvania's Secretary of Health, which will start its push around Labor Day. Second question, will the flu shot protect against COVID-19? And the answer is no. Number three, which kind of flu shot should I get? Some types protect against three strains of virus and some against four. Doctors said you should go for the quadrivalent, which is four, if you have a choice. It's recommended that people over 65 get a high-dose version of the shot that works better in older people. But don't hold out if a particular option is not available. I think the best vaccine for someone is the one they're easily able to obtain. Question number four, who should get a flu shot? A shot is recommended for almost everyone over the age of 6 months. Thomas Fetke and infectious disease specialist at Temple University said kids should definitely get the shot because they are big flu spreaders. Usually, fewer than half the people eligible for flu shots actually get them. Number five, where should I get the flu shot this year? As many as a fifth of people who are used to getting their vaccine through their employers, if they're working from home now, they may have to look to for alternatives like pharmacies, urgent care centers, doctor's offices, and vaccination drives. Bailey suggests calling your doctor to see if he or she will have the shots. Schaffner said some doctors will be scheduling flu shot appointments either early or late in the workday so they can be done quickly and efficiently. A CVS spokesman said the chain will begin making appointments for vaccines next month to make it easier for customers to get in and out fast. Joseph Teal, a family medical doctor in Pennsylvania, said Penn's practices are currently planning alternative locations to improve efficiency. Tan has said he has heard of plans to do drive-up vaccinations where people can just stick an arm out the window. Another possibility is outside shots for walkers or even vaccination stations under tents. And the last question, how is the government going to keep track of flu this year? In the past, the government's surveillance system has relied on tracking people with flu-like symptoms in some settings. It also tracked hospitalizations and deaths connected with flu-like symptoms and pneumonia. Now it has two viruses that cause similar symptoms and pneumonia. The prospect of a double-barreled flu/coronavirus season likely means there will be a lot more testing for both viruses. You can't just say someone has influenza-like symptoms, Levine said. Here's a report about some airports are swimming in undeclared cash. In Miami, if you're traveling with more than $10,000 in cash into or out of the United States, you better declare the money or you're likely to lose it. Especially if you're flying through Miami International Airport, ranked right up there with New York's JFK or Chicago's O'Hare airports, according to a new report on federal seizures of funds from travelers who do not fill out the right customs forms. The Miami airport ranks among the top five in the U.S. for federal seizures of money from travelers who do not legally declare it. A sum of almost $91.5 million at Miami Airport between 2000 and 2016, according to the report by the Institute for Justice, a Virginia-based law firm specializing in efforts to recover civil forfeitures by the government. Under federal law, travelers can carry as much money as they want in or out of the country, but if it's more than $10,000, they have to declare the amount to the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Although the Institute's report does not delve into MIA's reputation as a contraband hub, it has been recognized by law enforcement for decades as the conduit for cocaine and cash smuggling. The airport seizure report, based on statistics from a Treasury Department forfeiture database, focuses on travelers whose money was taken by Customs and Border Protection officers. Their typical crime is a failure to file required paperwork, declaring more than $10,000 in cash upon leaving or entering the country. The report, titled Jetway Robbery? Homeland Security and Cash Seizures at Airports, says that custom officers have seized $2 billion in more than 30,000 seizures at U.S. airports over the 17-year period. A big chunk of that total, $500 million, was confiscated because American and foreign travelers failed to declare more than $10,000 in cash. Such paperwork violations account for half of all the currency seizures and over a quarter of the total value seized, more than $500 million, most without a demonstrated connection to serious criminal activity. Federal law enforcement agencies are tasked with finding and punishing criminals, but these findings suggest the Department of Homeland Security airport currency seizure and forfeiture practices put innocent Americans at risk. In response to the report's findings, the U.S. Customs and Border Protection issued a statement saying travelers must obey the cash reporting law and the agency must enforce it. But the agency said it also tries to be flexible. Officers often grant travelers multiple opportunities to properly declare currency. Overall, Customs and Border Protection officials disagreed in part with the conclusion of the Institute's report. The most common reason for currency seizures is a failure to comply with the reporting. However, currency seized at ports of entry have also been connected with bulk cash smuggling, counterfeiting, narcotics traveling, and other criminal offenses. A person may petition for the return of their seized currency, but the petitioner must prove that the source and intended use of the currency was legitimate. The Institute's lawyers said that efforts can be arduous, taking months and years to recover the money. In other area news, Colorado reports 20 virus cases stemming from the Sturgis motorcycle rally. Colorado has reported more than 20 confirmed COVID-19 cases linked to people who attended an annual motorcycle event in Sturgis earlier this month. The pandemic was expected to reduce attendance at the Sturgis motorcycle rally, but the event drew some 462,000 people between August 7th and August 16th, down just 7% from the previous year. Some visitors wore masks and practiced social distancing in spite of the large crowds. State officials in Colorado are now asking those who attended the rally and have symptoms to be tested immediately, and have recommended those without symptoms be tested a week after suspected exposure. "No one that we went with or knew up there has had any symptoms," said Kevin Bolser, co-owner of the Lucky Horseshoe Customs in Inglewood. Bolser said members of his group took special precautions to camp in a remote area and self-quarantine after the event. In at least 8 other states, there have been reports coronavirus cases linked to the annual rally, tallying at least 100 people with the virus. South Dakota Republican Governor Kristi Noem has recently stated that she questions whether face masks prevent the spread of the coronavirus, saying there is very mixed research and the science has not proven what's effective and what isn't. Noem also welcomed those attending the rally in a tweet before the event started. "The number of infections is thought to be far higher because many people have not been tested, and studies suggest people can be infected with the virus without even feeling sick. For most people, the new coronavirus causes mild or moderate symptoms, such as fever and cough, that clear up in 2 to 3 weeks. For some, especially older adults and people with existing health problems, it can cause more severe illness, including pneumonia and death." Okay, I think that brings us to the conclusion of today's reading of the Sioux City Journal. Again, today is Monday, the 31st of August, the last day of August. And we are going to just do a quick recap of the weather before I sign off. Today is going to be a lovely day. Started out a little stormy, but high today of 78. And tonight will be a little cooler, and the rest of the week should be a lovely, with it getting heated up as we get closer to Wednesday and Thursday. So as we get closer in the week, things will get warmer. So stay cool. Thank you very much for joining me today in reading of the Sioux City Journal. I hope you have a safe and nice week ahead, and I'll be speaking to you next Monday. Thank you very much.
This is Tom Hatton with an Irish short take from the book A Culinary History of Iowa. An article we're reading now is entitled Manna Colonies Maintain Rich History in Iowa. The Icarians weren't the only communal society to play a role in Iowa's culinary history. The famous Manna Colonies in eastern Iowa were also founded on communal principles, but unlike the Icarians, the Mannas had a strong religious component. By the 1700s, people across northern Europe had become dissatisfied with the rituals and intellectualism of the Lutheran Church and had begun to rebel and separate from the Church. adherents to a new faith called the Community of True Inspiration formed their own self-reliant communities. Known as the Inspirationists, these men and women and their families found refuge in central Germany. Persecution and an economic depression in Germany in the 1830s, however, forced the community to search for a new home. Hundreds of Inspirationists immigrated to America in 1843 to 44 in search of religious freedom. They pooled their resources and established a community named Ebenezer near modern-day Buffalo, New York. All property was held in common. Farms and factories were established, and the community of nearly 1,200 people prospered. When more farmland was needed for the growing community, the Inspirationists looked to Iowa, where attractively priced land was available. A committee was sent to inspect land in Iowa in the mid-1850s. The Iowa River Valley proved particularly promising. Here, the men found acres of rich soil, good timber, water, limestone, sandstone, and clay necessary for establishing a new community. Leaders chose the name Amana, meaning remain true, from Song of Solomon 4:8. Starting in 1855, six villages were established a mile or two apart, including Amana, East Amana, West Amana, South Amana, High Amana, and Middle Amana. The village of Homestead was added in 1861, giving the Amana colonies access to the railroad. Each village had its own school, farm, and craft industries to make it virtually self-sufficient. The communal way of life was continued in Amana, much like it had been in Ebenezer. All property was held in common. Families were assigned housing in buildings owned by the Amana Society. Each individual worked at a designated job. Religious life was the strong unifying factor. In the seven villages, residents received a home, medical care, meals, all household necessities, and schooling for their children. Property and resources were shared. Men and women were assigned jobs by the Village Council of Brethren. No one received a wage. Farming and the production of wool and calico supported the community. But village enterprises, from clockmaking to brewing, were vital. Well-crafted products became a hallmark of the Amana colonies, which are still known for exceptional wines and more. People were called to work before dawn by the gentle tolling of the bell in the village tower in Old Amana, where the pace of life was much different than today. More than 50 communal kitchens provided three daily meals, as well as mid-morning and mid-afternoon snacks to all colonists. These kitchens were operated by the women of the Amana colonies and were well supplied by the village smokehouse, bakery, ice house, and dairy, as well as the orchards, vineyards, and huge communal gardens maintained by the villagers. During the growing season, there was plenty of work to do in the gardens and kitchens, from planting and harvesting to preparing and storing vegetables, from cabbage to turnips. Around 1900, for example, it wasn't unusual for the communal kitchens in just one Amana village to produce more than 400 gallons of sauerkraut. It took a lot of food and labor to sustain the villages within the Amana colonies. Children attended school 6 days a week, year-round, until age 14. Boys were then assigned jobs on the farm or in the craft shops, while girls were assigned to a communal kitchen or garden. Work and faith were often intertwined and were intertwined in the villages, where the Inspirationists attended worship services 11 times per week. Times were changing by the early 20th century, however. Improved communications and transportation in the 1920s began to exert their influence on the Amana colonies. In addition, the collapse of the American economy following the stock market crash of October 1929 left no aspect of daily life untouched. The Great Depression and disastrous farm economy made the isolated communal life in Amana socially and economically impossible. In the early 1930s, Amana set aside its communal way of life. A strong desire on the part of the residents to maintain their community finally propelled the change, according to Amana history shared by the Amana Colonies Convention and Visitors Bureau. By 1932, the communal way of life was seen as a barrier to achieving individual goals. Rather than leave or watch their children leave the community, the people of the Amana villages changed. Members voted to abandon the communal system and established the Amana Society Incorporated, a profit-sharing corporation to manage the farmland, mills, and larger enterprises. Private enterprise was encouraged. While this separated the economic aspect of the community from the church, the Amana Church Society continued to be the religious foundation of the community. Today, the seven villages of the Amana colonies are among the state's most popular tourist attractions. Declared a National Historic Landmark in 1965, the Amana colonies attract hundreds of thousands of visitors annually who come to experience a place where the past is cherished and hospitality is a way of life. The streets of the Amana colonies, lined with their historic brick, stone, and clapboard houses, their flower and vegetable gardens, and their lanterns and walkways, recall the Amana of yesterday. Many museums are available for tours, including the communal kitchen in Middle Amana, preserved just as it was on the day in 1932 when the last communal meal was served in the colony. The communal kitchen lets you step back in time. Guides explain kitchen routines and share insights on communal life. Guests can also enjoy a satisfying taste of Amana history and hospitality at the famous Ox Yoke Inn, a full-service restaurant founded in 1940 in the village of Amana. The Ox Yoke Inn's nationally recognized reputation of fresh, quality food served family style reflects the restaurant's old-world signature dishes. The Ox Yoke Inn serves traditional German and American favorites at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, as well as on Sunday brunch buffet. Glimpses of the past are also preserved in some of the gardens in the Amana colonies. With the passing of the Old Order in 1932, the number of the Society's large vegetable gardens and orchards dwindled, but Larry Reddick and his wife Wilma still grow some of the colony's heirloom varieties in their fourth-generation South Amana vegetable garden. In 1980, they founded a seed bank to preserve heirloom plants for the future generations. In his 2013 book, Gardening the Amana Way, Reddick's chapters on modern vegetable and flower gardening in today's Amana colonies showcase his cottage in the meadow gardens, now listed with the Smithsonian's Archives of American Gardens. Old intermingles with new across Reddick's gardens as heirloom lettuce keeps company with the latest cucumber variety. It's a living tribute to the unique history of Amana colonies and one of America's longest-lived communal societies. And that was an excerpt from a culinary history of Iowa by Darcy Doherty, Malsey, and other offbeat stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.